We're here to make a dent in the universe, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. Good afternoon and welcome to my podcast today. And we are deep in homeschooling here, so please excuse children yelling and running around and dogs barking. That's just the way we're living these days, isn't it? So today I have a great guest who I've been looking forward to having ever since I connected with him on LinkedIn, and it's Neil Usher. And Neil has wrestled with complex change problems for almost 40 years, solving them with a rare blend of straightforward and creative thinking, together with an eye for both strategy and detail. He brings a wealth of client-side management and leadership experience from around the world in a variety of industries, including at Warner Brothers, Honeywell, Rio Tinto, and Sky. And he's presently a chief workplace and change strategist at GoSpace AI, the first artificial intelligence application for the workplace. He's been actively blogging about work for over a decade, and his first book, The Elemental Workplace, was published in 2018. This is actually his second book, and we're going to talk quite a lot about this. He's a sought-after conference and academic speaker and always brings a fresh perspective. And he dispels with many assumptions and myths. And again, we're going to talk about that. And I love how he wraps through, he threads throughout his book a number of cultural references, many of which I understood and got as well, being Australian. So that was very good. And I don't normally do this, because these are sort of, I ask each guest to send through some of their points of discussion, and I don't normally share them. They're normally just for me, but I'm going to share Neil's because they're really good. And perhaps if anyone listening has any questions on these particular topics, ask away. He always knew he'd write a book someday, but was convinced it would be fiction. And he says rather humorously, some say that both the ones that he's written are fiction. He wrote his first degree thesis on, and I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, Dostoevsky, and became a little obsessed with 19th century Russian literature. He used to do performance poetry and has had several songs published. Perhaps we should get him to sing. I've done that on a podcast before. And his blog, Work Essence, ran for 10 years, and he took it down last year. At some point, we'll publish it as a charity ebook. Neil, thank you so much. Hi, Neil. How was that for an introduction?
That was fantastic. Thanks. When it's out there and I can snip it out, I might save that one. Thank you.
It's funny sometimes hearing an introduction of yourself and saying, they're talking about me. Wow. Okay. And it must be a really proud moment for you to have book number two published, because book number two, I know, is so much harder than book number one.
I was reading an autobiography of a singer-songwriter that I really liked over the Christmas period, and he said it takes, for most bands, it takes 20 years to make the first album, and then they have to make the second one in 6 months. So it's a similar sort of process with the book, really, this idea that everyone's got a book in them. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it's all of your life experience and your learning, and you bring it all together, which is exactly why I sat down and wrote the first one. And that really was what it was. It was a complete brain dump. It was everything I'd been doing for the last 25 years. And then with the second one, it takes a lot more sort of deeper thinking, and, you know, you go off for all sorts of tangents, takes a lot longer to bring it all together. And if I thought I was a bit mad doing the first one, I think at various points of writing the second one, I really seriously doubted my sanity.
Yeah, no, I can imagine that. I wrote my first one really quickly as well. And then, yeah, it's much harder now to bring that second one. I think also if you've had a degree of success with your first one and good response, you think, well, there's only one way from here. But I must say, I haven't read your first book, but I found this second book, I found your book very interesting. And as I've pointed out to you, I've got a series of highlighted bits throughout here that I'm looking forward to discussing today. And I think what's really important to point out is while you work in workspace change and change within a corporate environment, this book can be used more on a, even on a personal level, when it comes to change and leadership and management, it's not just for those working in corporates, and that's the beauty of it.
And that was the starting point, really, when I you know, started thinking that I might sort of create something around change was, you know, is there any difference between the changes that we drive and we desire in our personal lives and those in the corporate world? Because, as we know, quite a lot happens the other side of the sort of reception revolving door. We start speaking differently, we behave differently, we do different things. We really do almost think and talk in a language that we would never use at home or in the pub or anywhere. We use words that really only belong on the other side of the, you know, sort of air side of the revolving door. So is that the same with change? And, you know, very early conclusion was that absolutely no difference at all. And I during the course of the research came across a lot of material that suggested that we naturally resist change, that we're hardwired to resist change, even psychologically sort of disposed towards rejecting and, you know, resisting change. And I got to thinking, really, that, you know, it, sort of Homo sapiens has been on this planet for 300,000 years. And if we think about the progress that we've made through that desire for change in everything we do, everything we're about, from the most personal minutiae through to sort of grand, large scale schemes, projects, initiatives, effectively, it's sort of 3,000 years, really. It's 1% of the time that Homo sapiens has spent on the planet. The progress we've made in that time is all driven by a natural and an innate thirst for change and a desire for change.
That's right. And you just have to look at the personal development space to realize that we all have this desire to, well, not all of us, but obviously the majority of us have this desire to improve ourselves. But I don't think we see that improvement as change. And it does require perhaps reading about it to say, oh yeah, that desire to better myself is actually a desire for change.
And that's why I spent some time in the book on those reflections, the sort of the why of change. I think a lot of the material that I came across out there skips over that, almost assumes that we naturally or just, you know, innately know that. But I don't think we do. And I don't think we actually spend enough time thinking about what change means, what change is, how it works in our relations with one another, and how central it is to what we are, that change is literally everything. It is our essence. We have a finite time on this planet, and through that whole time we are evolving and adapting and changing. It is the very essence of humanity and what it means to be a human being. So to kind of abstract in it away and think of it as something external to us that's over there that somehow we can manage in some way, or we can choose to accept or reject as a thing in itself, is entirely the wrong way to look at it. So I thought the sort of the reflections part of it was very important. During the course of showing the draft book to a number of people, some people sort of really got into that section and loved that bit and weren't so bothered with the practical aspects. Some said, look, I might come back to all these reflections later because I'm really interested in the sort of practical and the, you know, the things I can do. But it was really important to me in putting the whole thing together that I told the end-to-end story.
I just want to read something, if I may. And it's probably best if I got you to, but I've got it right in front of me here. And this is right from the beginning, the opening gambit, which is quite topical given that you use this, and then there's a whole Netflix series called the Queen's Gambit. So anyway, which is excellent, by the way. We can't step outside change, but we can lead it from within. When leading change, we can't abstract from ourselves from it. Somewhere, our own life, our career, relationships, or reputation will be tangled up with what we've been asked to do. And so we're within the story. Due to the interconnectedness of all things, we're inherently conflicted, but so is everyone. We instinctively regard conflicted as negative, but it's simply a reality. And that for me was, that was really powerful. And it's right at the very beginning of book that we are by nature conflicted because we're all putting our lens, we're seeing things through our own lenses.
Absolutely. And this sort of tangled mess, you know, it sort of says on the back, you know, change is messy, but so is life. It's and one of the things that's been really apparent, I think, since lockdown, first lockdown, so, you know, not far short of a year ago, really, is this sort of dealing for individuals dealing with uncertainty. But this mess that we're embroiled in, that we're conflicted in, is actually where the opportunities arise. Most organizations, and to an extent in our lives, we try and iron out uncertainty. We want to be able to plan in a very linear way. We want to be certain of what's going to happen. And it actually takes quite a sort of a, you know, quite a step for us, really, to say, well, actually, if we can plan everything, if we have this absolute certainty, then not much that's interesting is going to happen, because we're going to know exactly what's going to happen, because we're going to know all the steps on the path we're about to take. And so, you know, realistically for us, we have to see this mess that we're embroiled in as an incredible space to be in. All of the opportunities that present themselves to us, because all of these parts, all of these pieces, and all of the other people in this sort of messy environment are all moving, doing different things at different times. They are all interrelated, and the gaps that open up are those that we need to step into. They're the opportunities we need to take. They're often time constrained. You know, they're not going to be there forever, because the plates will keep shifting and the pieces mm-hmm. will keep moving in what we see before us, and we keep moving through that as well. But it's actually an incredibly optimistic picture, I think, of the present and the future. And so while when we're sort of, you know, locked down at home thinking about sort of, you know, thinking about the days when everything used to be certain, actually, you know, there is an amazing opportunity in the present and the near future for us.
That's right. And it's not all down to fate. And you wrote very succinctly about that with the Stoic movement in Athens in third century. And you wrote, aren't the Greeks always so intelligent? But even if we decide to do something instinctively crazy at this very moment, it could be argued it was always intended to happen, and that the notion of spontaneity is an illusion. But you and I both agree that that's not the case. There's no such thing, we don't think, as fate. And yet some people say, well, it's all in God's hands, or it's all in the universe's hands. It's fatalistic in a way.
Well, as a sort of keen football supporter, I'm always amazed at how many people sort of think that by wearing a particular pair of socks or shirt or something to a game, they're somehow going to influence the outcome. It's like, oh my God, you know, I knew we were going to lose because I didn't wear my lucky socks. It's this sort of notion somehow that by not doing what we should be doing, somehow we're sort of challenging that sort of the inevitability here. And it's, you know, as we suggested, it's really hard to argue. If I was to sort of, you know, throw my cup of tea across the room right now and say, well, that wasn't intended, was it? Someone would always come back and say, well, of course it was. You know, your act of what you believe to be spontaneity was always planned. And this conversation we're having that prompted it was always planned as well. It's almost, you can't argue that. It's entirely circular. But I think that, you know, it's a very sort of negative perception of life and very negative perception of environment. And I think, again, it's always quite refreshing to lay out that historical timeline and just think about that 1% and think about 3,000 years of incredible progress. And you mentioned the Athenians being unbelievably clever. I mean, the amount of wisdom in a society that was still relatively simple, you know, what the ancient Greeks knew of the world in terms of the sort of environment and physicalities around them and structures and even the numbers of people in those days. I mean, it is extraordinary that there was so much wisdom at that time that we're, to a huge degree, we're just adding footnotes to it as we go. You know, most of what we understand today in some way, then we come up with an idea or a thought, or we read something on a LinkedIn post, and that's really good. Somewhere along the line, you can probably trace the germ of the idea back to the ancient Greeks. It was just an unbelievably rich source of wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. We're having some questions come through here as well, which is fantastic. Please keep them coming. I'm actually going to park this question, however, until we get onto the leadership and management. So there's a question here on covert or consensual employee monitoring. So anyway, we'll park that until we get onto leadership. I think that will be a good one to address then. First of all, though, I wanted to talk about this concept that of change, that it's a perpetual beta. Because for me, I thought that this was really, really interesting, and also fed into another point that you made about the Viz comic, and how at the end he would always say, yet another partial success. And so change succeeds by degree, not in the absolute. And we've got to get over this mindset that change happens and then that's how we're going to be. But that's not the case. It's changes by degree. Do you want to unpack that a little more?
Yes, Professor Piehead and his indomitable spirit and willingness to experiment in Viz Comic. If anybody's old enough to remember the sort of the earlier versions of Viz, I'm sure the authors of Viz didn't envisage for a minute that he was going to become a sort of, you know, change leadership hero in some way at all. But I think I think that sort of contribution really based on sort of that willingness to experiment and that continual desire for experimentation. And perpetual beta is a lovely phrase, lovely idea. It was borrowed from software development. The workplace property sector has a habit of borrowing all of its best ideas from software, which seems to be significantly further ahead in thinking in many instances, like Agile was borrowed from software development as well. But the idea of perpetual beta being that sort of nothing is ever finished, I think ties in perfectly with the way that change is and the way that change operates, which is that it is this continual experiment. But the critical part that often gets missed in perpetual beta, when people just think it means everything constantly changing, is that there is this feedback loop that the consumers of a product or a service are part of its, you know, that they're part of the design team, that they're co-creators of the eventual outcome. So, you know, we cover in the book a lot about sort of communication and messaging and feedback and listening and you know, that all ties in as well, really, which is this effective feedback loop enables things to constantly evolve, but constantly evolve to meet the needs of the people consuming that product or service. When a software product is created and its version numbering kicks in, it's very unlikely that the originators of that product, when they first attach a version, they'll have any idea where it's going to stop. Now, it just continually moves. And if you've got any kind of sort of operating system, which you're bound to have on your phones and your tablets or PCs, and, you know, you'll continually see applications and operating systems updating. They are constantly evolving, and that as an idea, really, in terms of everything we do in our professional lives, is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, and again, it comes back to this feedback loop, which you said that you talked a lot about that. And one thing I also found really interesting, and I sort of stepped back and started thinking about in what I'm doing, is vision statements and how to, not just how to get people to buy into those vision statements, but how to make them more compelling than just something that you stick on the intranet or up on the wall. And what you've suggested is a question. And that is a really interesting way of doing it that I've never even heard of before. So do you want to talk to us about that?
Yes, I it's not my idea, so I'm not sort of claiming sort of sole credit for thinking of this. But when I first came across it in an article or something somewhere, it's one of those ideas that kind of seeded with me and then emerged later, really. But what I was really interested in was, or what I was really wrestling with was, you know, where do we get to with a vision statement where it actually means anything to anyone, rather than just being a bit of sort of corporate flam, really? You know, is it how do we actually make it something that's worth doing, worth having, and that we can tie everything we do back to? Because, you know, at the end of the day, the vision statement sits in the roof space. Everything else we do hangs off that. So it has to remain relevant. It's probably one of the few things in the change initiative that doesn't change, that has a degree of longevity, because all of the rest of what we're doing needs to hang off something that continually reminds us why we're doing it. But the idea being that a question kind of hijacks the brain. There's almost nothing you can do to stop yourself trying to answer it. If someone says to you, you know, ask you a question about something to do with your life or what you're working on, you might not be distracted by it immediately, but it will usually come back to you. And not just the hijacking of the brain and the engagement of you in that question and in the sort of search for that answer, but you feel involved. You feel like you're part of it. You feel like you've got something to contribute, because in asking the question, it feels like it's being asked of you personally. And a leader of a change initiative could be addressing thousands of people that are likely to be affected by this. And all of those thousands of people will think, well, they want my input. They want my response. And that's where that feedback loop starts. That's where the dialogue is created and everybody feels like they're part of it. So rather than saying, you know, our aim is to be the leader in providing this product across the world, by saying something like, how do we become the leader in providing this product across the world, makes people think, wow, you know, there's things I would do. And how do I get those across? And so suddenly we're opening the door to all this insight, collected knowledge and experience of all of our colleagues. And as long as we've then got the means to capture that and to process that, we've started a really important part of the change initiative. We just give people a statement. Most of the time, it will go in one ear and out the other, and it won't necessarily mean anything, or it will feel like just highbrow corporate stuff. Question has so much more power.
Yeah, and again, with buy-in, it's so important that people do feel that this is something that they also agree with and that they can be part of. And so having that question that allows them to talk about to their leaders about their stories. And I think that, again, with having that as a question, it invites your colleagues or your team members to tell their stories and share their stories. And you talk a lot about how collecting and collating stories is a vital leadership behavior. And it's about collecting them from anyone who's, say, client-focused or back-office-focused or anyone that has an impact in that organization, which is really every single part, and just really hearing what they say and how they feel that question should be answered. And before you comment on that, I just wanted to take this back to if people are saying, well, that's all great in a corporate environment, but I'm a solopreneur or I'm a mumpreneur, and you can hear my children in the background there with the microwave going and coming into the room. How does that work for me if I'm sitting at home working on my kitchen table? And for me, how I interpreted this is it's about having a purpose or a mission statement or a vision question for yourself. And anytime you get offered something else, you test it against that question. And if it doesn't fit within that question or that purpose or that mission, you can't accept it. So it's I'm pulling something completely randomly. If you work on marketing for financial services and an estate agency comes to you and say, hey, can you do my marketing, please? Does it fit your question of how can we be the best at marketing financial services? No, it doesn't. So you can't accept that. You're never going to be the very best that you can be. And yeah, so that was just to relate that back to people who are listening who might be working for with themselves or running much smaller organizations than the large corporates that you've worked with. But just if you could comment on that as well and how you see it relating to smaller companies. And also this, they're really listening to the stories of the people who work within these organizations as well.
I mean, I don't think vision questions always have to be grandiose. They don't always have to be sort of, you know, aiming for something that feels almost unachievable. They can actually be related to very sort of, you know, straightforward and simple initiatives that will just make a significant difference. So I think sort of at whatever level you're operating, the idea of the vision question is still important. And it is a useful tester. Actually, I quoted from something completely different, a book, There Is an Eye in Team, a chap called Mark Durand, and he spent some time with a rowing club, a really sort of, you know, elite sport rowing club. And I think someone who was at the club for some time, surname was Stevens, and he talks about what he calls the Stevens question. And I don't talk about this in the book, this is another anecdote, but the Stevens question was always, you know, will it make the boat go faster? And it was the question that they related to just about everything they did at the rowing club. You know, someone said, look, you know, boat's looking a bit shabby. Should we paint it this weekend? It's like, you know, will it make the boat go faster? Well, not really. So why are we wasting our time and energy focusing on painting the boat when we don't need to? So I think sometimes when there is sort of more of an imperative, having a sort of Stevens question like that is actually quite important too. So it might not be the vision question might not necessarily be, you know, an aim to be something or to achieve something, but it might be a useful point at which we test our activity and we test our thinking at every point in time, because everything else has to hang off it. I'm amazed sometimes with projects I think through and I've been involved in the past where the vision statement, because most of them have usually been statements, doesn't really have a lot to do with the objectives that are set. And then a whole new set of KPIs are created and the measurement of the success of the project doesn't seem to bear any relation to the objectives and absolutely no relation whatsoever to the vision. It's absolutely vital that these things hang together. But in a way, they tell their own story. So that when the initiative is deemed to be complete, everybody understands the path they've been on and everybody understands the story and they can tell that story. It's just having some cohesion about everything we're doing, whether it's an individual, whether it's a small enterprise or a large organization, in any of these initiatives, cohesion is absolutely vital and that all of these creations do hang together from start to finish.
Yeah, and you summarize it really well in your part two wrap up, where you say we shouldn't tell people about our dream and ask them to follow it. We should ask them to dream and tell us about it. We share the vision that way. And I put it that way, and I don't want to ruin, you're such a wordsmith, I don't want to ruin it. But we should ask them to dream and tell us about it. And that's where asking a question allows that to happen. I want to move now on to leadership versus management. And I do believe this is something that people, they think they understand, but you have articulated it very well. So can you take us through your understanding and the way that you've articulated the difference between leadership and management?
Yeah, it was probably the section of the book which I knew I had to write about. I probably approached with the greatest degree of trepidation and probably had more imposter syndrome and sort of self-doubt about than any, because it's covered everywhere. I mean, it's just such a rich seam of literature and thinking and, you know, wisdom. But what's quite interesting is, despite all of that, we've never really bottomed it out in any way at all. You know, we're still talking about it. We still talk about the failings of management and the failings of leadership. And, you know, I think sort of anyone watching the news in the last 24 hours would probably be able to draw on a few examples there as well. So despite all of that wisdom and despite all of that literature, we still haven't actually sort of solved it. But I guess the sort of the real difference that I was trying to identify is that management is much more about control and sort of looking inwards and just making sure that as much uncertainty is removed from what we're about. And leadership, which comes with its own risks and its own downsides in that respect, is much more focused on opportunity and actually sort of more outward focused and more likely to involve risk rather than risk mitigation. But actually, the important point here is that, you know, a degree of leadership and a degree of management are entirely complementary and need to run together. It's fairly unusual in our professional lives that we encounter people who are managers without being leaders and people who are leaders without having to do some management. We kind of have to, you know, whatever role we're in, we have to do a bit of both. One might outweigh the other. And most of the people that we encounter probably have a leaning towards one or the other, towards, you know, the inward looking control oriented management processes or the more outward looking, more sort of, you know, risk hungry leadership. But any successful change initiative needs the blend of both, and it needs those to dovetail effectively in order to deliver that. But the difficulty with change is we almost sort of instinctively use the term change management. But certainly in the property sector, most of what we talk about in relation to change is managing that process, not leading it. And I think part of the problem there is particularly within this sector, it's usually the case that change has been seen as a downstream plug-in somehow, that we take all the really important decisions, we do all the interesting work, the search for properties, the design, all of those sorts of things. And then at some point in time, we want to make sure that it goes well, that people do what we expect them to do, that they behave in ways we expect them to behave. So we sort of plug this change management service in. And we forget, actually, that all of those associated with that initiative have actually been leading change from the outset, probably before we even thought it had started, and it will continue long after we think it's finished. So I'd rather see the term change leadership used a lot more readily than just purely change management. I think it's something that's missing in our industry, because I think that we're actually all leaders of change, and we're all primarily leaders of change. And actually, the plug-in, the downstream plug-in, is our particular specialism or expertise. The downstream plug-in is not managing change. And I can remember a few situations I've been in the past where I've been sort of pitching for change work or been asked to consider change work where it's almost been a fait accompli, and all someone wants, you know, all the decisions have been taken. Mm-hmm. The selected space has been designed. This is what we're having. Can you make it? Can you do the change? Well, we can't work like that. You know, change is constant. Change is always happening, and we are leaders of change. And so, yes, we might need to apply some management principles and processes just to make sure things don't run away with themselves. But we also need to effectively and successfully lead it too.
Yeah. So the leader really needs to inspire that vision of change, and not work. It's kind of like that working on your business work versus working in your business. And again, to take this back to a smaller business example, that the leader is the one who works on that business and provides the inspiration for that vision, while the manager works in the business, ensuring that those steps continue to happen to make that perpetual change. It must be really hard then to measure the success of change within an organization when it is a perpetual beta.
Absolutely. And there's a horrible statistic out there that another author has recently entirely dismantled, and it was long overdue in being dismantled. Which is that 70% of all change initiatives fail.
Wow.
It doesn't come from anywhere. It's got no basis in research or fact. It's just one of those statements that appears to have been continually quoted. So the next person quotes the last person, and so it goes on in a sort of chain fashion almost. But this particular author's conclusion was that it was probably nearer 6%. And it's back to, you know, our old friend Professor Piehead and another partial success, really, which is that, you know, that what we do with the change initiative is we apply artificial bookends. You know, the start and finish are usually fairly arbitrary dates that we assign to these things. And part of the difficulty we have in sort of measuring the success of a change initiative is that as it progresses, it is often morphing into other initiatives. It is becoming something else. And some of the sort of threads of our change initiative are moving off in other directions. So at the point in time that we apply that artificial bookend and say this is now finished, chances are quite a lot of what we've been working on has become something else already and someone else's initiative. It's quite possible that some elements of it were concluded and nothing more needed to be done, and some will continue long after the bookend that we impose. So it's really difficult with change because it is perpetual. It's really difficult with change to actually contain it, to bookend it, to then be able to assess it in that way. We can assess certain aspects of what we've tried to do. You know, we can measure some of those, and that's perfectly viable. But to measure it in its entirety and then say it's done, we don't have to do any more, is almost an impossibility that flies in the face of the nature of change itself.
Yeah, that's right. And just on the whole leadership management, do you think that leaders and managers are born or created?
I did suggest in there when I was looking at a comparison that it's a sort of popularly held view that leaders are born and managers are created. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I think there's a whole leadership development industry out there that would also disagree with that. I think we can always be better at managing, and we can always be better at leading, and we can always learn. And if we think about our own lives and we think about how we were when we were in our teens or early 20s, and we think about how we are today, you know, we probably conquered a lot of our fears and probably improved on a lot of things that we set out to do so in those early days. I mean, I can remember being unbelievably painfully shy as a teenager, and it's something I had to work on. And I set myself the task of overcoming that. And a lot of the experience in overcoming that was quite horrible, really. It was volunteering to do talks in front of people and being utterly terrified of standing up and talking in front of an audience. I still have to deal with that now if I'm doing a conference talk with, you know, real people in real space. But it's something I've learned to deal with and something I've learned to get through. So I think, you know, even some of the things that we think we're born with, we can overcome. We can develop our own strategies to do that. So I think it's perfectly possible to create fantastic leaders. And I think it's perfectly possible to create fantastic managers too. I think we're born with certain characteristics that might lean us in a certain direction. But I think, you know, a lot of the time it's a very easy excuse to say that someone can't do something because they weren't born to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You've got this great table here where you differentiate between the various roles of leaders and managers and key attributes: character versus skills, character timeline, experience, authority, power, and perception of origin. Leaders are perceived to be born and managers are perceived to be made and brought up through the ranks. And another thing you've got here, which is really lovely, is you've included this poem, this small 25-word poem by Simon Heath on the role of leaders. I think this is, I'm not misquoting this, but it's called 25, and this is the role of leaders. I don't know if I'm now misquoting this, but anyway, I really like this poem. I'm going to read it anyway, and then you can tell me. Listen, include, ask them, be clear, get out of the way, stay out of the way, follow through, trust them, have their backs, and be present.
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece of work by Simon. He's an amazingly talented writer and illustrator. In fact, he illustrated my first book, so it was a nice way to create some continuity by having Simon involved in this one. But that piece of work that he put in his blog some time ago has been quoted by many people and used by many people. I think I reduced it to something even a little smaller than that in the end. But
yeah. Don't be an ass.
Which really is, yeah. That used to be a lot of people's social media policies in the very early days of Twitter and sort of back in sort of 2010, 2011. People say, you know, we've got this social media tool. You know, we need a policy. What should it be? And most people just say, don't be an ass. You know, yeah. And really, at the end of the day, you know, a little bit like a, you know, we could probably ask ourselves a leadership vision question, really, in terms of what type of leader do we want to be. There's, you know, we can use some of the techniques and suggestions in the book to answer questions in other parts of the book, and that's probably one that would be a test for ourselves, really, in terms of the things we think, the decisions we take, the way we are with people. We're human beings. We're still going to get things wrong. We're still going to misjudge things. We're still going to make mistakes. But we then have an opportunity when that happens to recover, to reposition ourselves, to make amends for whatever has happened, to be honest and to own up, which I find is sort of one of the most endearing qualities of a leader or manager, is being prepared to take responsibility and to own up to that. And we can move on from there. So we in being human and making those mistakes, we can also be human and fix them afterwards.
Yeah, and show humility. And that to me is such an important character trait of a leader or anyone who wants to position themselves as a leader in the future, is having that humility and not having that blame. There's such a strength that comes from someone owning up, especially a manager, owning up to an issue rather than throwing one of their team under the bus for that. I just want to talk now about where we all find ourselves at this time. This is being recorded on the 7th of January, 2021. You were very lucky that you got some of the pandemic, the first lockdown, in your book before it went to print. So that's really good that you got to put some of that context into it. But how has the whole change management industry changed now with the pandemic and the working from home? And we've got this question on employee monitoring and trust, and just if you could talk about how this might have changed now that we're all finding ourselves in very different working environments.
Yeah, I think we've had to think about change probably a lot more than we did before. You know, I was often asked, "Is, you know, did you start writing this when after the first lockdown?" I probably could have just about, you know, given the typical timeline for publishing a book, it might just about have squeezed into that timeline. And I know that a number of books that came out during the lockdown were started at the beginning of the lockdown. And I think that was quite apparent that, you know, you need to spend time with a book before you publish it. Just brushing it out usually shows. So I mentioned the pandemic in there a couple of times, I think, but I didn't want it to become the prime focus because I'm not sure that, other than helping us really to be a little bit more introspective and to think about change a little bit more and what it means to us, I'm not necessarily sure that its impact is far-reaching in respect of change itself. I think it will obviously be impactful in respect of the industries that we work in. Some have blossomed and some and probably more, you know, a larger number have suffered incredibly during this period of time, and they will be dealing with their own changes as an industry, and those firms will be dealing with the changes they have to make, you know, but in the latter category, those that need to make changes in order simply to survive. And those that have found themselves with tools, products, services that have been much in demand during lockdown are actually sort of working out how they have to change in order to survive in a good way, in terms of continue to provide those services and not be buried under the demand. So yes, organisations and sectors and industries have had to be a lot more sort of agile, really, in the way they're dealing with this. But I think this period has been a really interesting mix between things that appear to be moving quickly and things that appear then to be completely on hold and in some state of limbo. And in the whole workplace field, there's been a huge amount of debate over the last 9, 10, 11 months about what it all means for offices and the workplace and the future for our urban centres. And, you know, fortunately, at last, it's sort of seeping out beyond just the workplace, but into the whole urban environment and urban planning. And you know, we've really struggled as a sector because, you know, it's been almost impossible for anyone to make a move. It's almost like everyone's on the start line, sort of looking along the line, saying, you know, who's going to take a step first so we can learn from you. Nobody wants to be the organisation that gets it wrong and everybody learns from for their mistake. So there's a huge amount of caution, but I think one of the things it plays back to in the book that's incredibly important is that I try to be clear on the fact that preparation is much more important than planning. And we talked about certainty and uncertainty. Now, planning's quite possible when we have a certainty or a degree of certainty. If we know what we know or we know what we don't know, we can plan, or we can plan with options, and we can look at the potential routes we'll take. But a whole of the second part of the book on how we lead change is all about sort of what I've called the operating system of change. And it's got six components to it. But this is all about being prepared. And so I think the organizations that are going to be the most successful from here on are those who are not necessarily trying to sort of bake a plan into what they need to do. They might have some short-term planning in hand, but it's about their degree of preparation for anything that may arise, anything that may come at them, or the changes that take place in that sort of interconnected environment they're in. So preparation is a much sort of higher order, if you like, than planning. Planning just becomes part of the resources that we deploy in a change initiative. But being actually prepared for leading change is an entirely different prospect than coming up with a plan.
Yeah, that was similar to the train of thought or the forecasts and comments by Savills yesterday. They held a webinar on the future of property, including central business districts and other commercial offices. And they were talking about the winners and the losers. And very interestingly, their economist there, Matt Oakley, said that what they haven't seen is any new trends arise. What they have seen is a rapid acceleration of trends that were already in play. And I think that's what you're talking about with the planning of things is to just look where things have started to move towards and just map out where they could go and be ready for those eventualities.
It's interesting, actually. I've been doing quite a lot of sort of pondering on this idea that trends have been accelerated, and I'm not necessarily sure that's true, actually. I think it's become one of those things that we all say. It's one of those little phrases that we just continually repeat. And actually, if we start to pick it apart, a lot of the trends that that are occurring in our industry, have they been accelerated, or are we just doing a little more of what we were already doing? And we may well go back to doing a little less in the future. I think it's a healthy subject for a bit more debate, and needs to be challenged a little more going forward. Otherwise, it'll just be another one of these sort of empty statements. Mm-hmm. I think that there are probably a number of trends that we haven't yet seen emerge, and we're going to see some interesting. I think we'll see some interesting developments during the course of this year, because I think we'll really test it when the vaccine has hopefully won its battle with the virus, and when people are allowed to move a little more freely and allowed to socialize again. It's only then that we'll really start to learn whether these trends were accelerated or whether it was all entirely artificial. Because I think we need to sort of take the learning from this period and then take that forward into the sort of next phase of our lives in this sector, and understand really whether we have taken anything out of this, or whether we were literally just in some kind of crisis mode, and that was just suitable for a short period of time, and then we've moved back into another mode and moved forward into another mode. We don't know that yet, but I think it's safe to say that we still need to monitor these trends, but whether they have any particular future or whether they're just sort of very short term expedient responses, I think is yet to play out.
Mm. Yeah, well, Matt Oakley at Savills, if you'd like to come on and discuss that with me in more detail, I'd be very happy to have you on. And Neil, we've got some questions and comments here, if you're happy to answer them. And if anyone else listening has got more comments and questions, please just put them in the comment boxes. So this is the question that I raised earlier. This LinkedIn user is saying they're interested in your take on covert or consensual employee monitoring while working from home.
Is there such a thing as consensual monitoring? I'm not sure. It depends what degree we consider to be consensual, really, whether it's sort of
trust, isn't it?
It is, and trust has been a massive subject of conversation in the last 9-10 months, as has to be when we are physically separated from one another. So a lot of the signals that we give in relation to trust are harder to offer, and they're harder to receive. So I think we have had to really sort of ponder trust over that period of time. I think there are some fantastic technologies out there, obviously the technology that our firm provides, I think, that's necessary. But I think there are a number of technologies that are emerging that are sort of being progressed because they can be rather than they need to be. I think there is a degree of being able to determine that people are sort of living up to their commitments and meeting their responsibilities. But I think what was quite interesting was pre-pandemic, most workplaces were very geared towards measurement on input. The fact we were in the office, the time we spent there, being seen, being heard, it was very input oriented. And then shortly after lockdown, there was almost a joy that we'd reverted to what I consider almost to be the equal and opposite tyranny, which is measurement by output, which is actually quite a sort of an early 20th century idea from Taylor and others. And then given some sort of meat on the bones by Peter Drucker as well. But actually, I think one of the things that we're starting to learn beneficially is that it's about the contribution we make, and the output of our work is one aspect of the contribution. But there's a huge amount that people do in the workplace that is very difficult to determine, to measure. The mentoring, the support, the ideas, the sort of pastoral elements of what people do in the workplace, that is all part of that contribution. Some of us are in roles that are very output driven and output oriented. They're generally more process type of roles, but those associated with creativity, innovation, it's very difficult to turn those into output oriented roles. So I think a lot of these technologies that actually are starting to seep through, which are about sort of monitoring performance. It depends entirely on the job. It depends entirely on the organization. Instinctively, I don't like them. That's just a personal view and a personal preference. I'd rather that we dealt with sort of management at a human level. But I do appreciate there is a need for some degree of just making sure that contribution is valid and is important to the organization. How we do that, I still think there are very human ways to do that rather than sort of measuring keystrokes and leaving cameras on all day.
Yeah, it's, I guess I've come from a banking background. So we were always told that for compliance purposes, every email was being monitored and every single message. And so when social media first came about, anything like Facebook that had a messenger function was switched off, and Instagram and anything where you could bypass the compliance. And I knew people whose sole job was to screen every single email for certain words. So coming from that background, it was a given that everything was monitored, but it is quite intrusive. And as I said initially, it does come down to trust, perhaps, and a shift in mindset for the managers / leaders in output versus input. Richie has raised a question, which I'm not sure if this is within your scope, but what advice do you give to emotionally detach yourself from a situation that may arise with issues from employees in the working environment? Within my organization, it's something I've seen over a number of years, and as a result, it can cause long-term friction between individuals, whether that's not speaking to each other or going out of their way to make life difficult. Oh yeah, it's that whole the workplace politics. And as I guess someone who's looking to instill new values and a new vision within a corporation, how do you deal with the unique personalities within an organization and how they interact with each other? Is this something that you want to address?
I think that's a whole nother podcast, actually. it's a great question, but I'm not sure it's possible to deal with it quickly. But just to have a go, it's sort of related to the last point, really. It's accepting that all workplaces will be to some degree political. It's almost impossible to iron out the politics of a workplace because people do have their own aims and their own agendas. And I've always been amazed that just about every workplace operates on a very individual basis. You know, you're recruited individually, your objectives are individual, your tasks are individual, your assessment, your end of year appraisal is individual. Actually, I think one of the remedies for this type of approach in an inherently political environment is for that to be a lot more team oriented, because we all work in teams. Hardly any of us work exclusively alone in a large organization or even a small organization. We're usually working with others, and the contribution we make is usually a shared one. And so I think one of the ways of actually sort of dismantling some of the sort of personal agendas and the, because it's usually the personal that drives the political, is to actually recognize that in working with other people, in working in teams, that effectively we can be managed in teams and we can be assessed in teams and our contribution can be valued as a member of a team. And we might be in several teams. And so, back to trust again, trust is an important component of a team. But I think that would start to dismantle organizations usually say two things at once. They say, it's really important you're working in teams, all about, you've got to be a team player. But what did you do this year? And let's assess your contribution. Well, actually, if you worked as a team and you made a contribution as a team, then let's have a look at the value that team created.
Yeah, that's a really unique way of looking at it. Again, going back to my corporate days of working in large organizations such as Goldman Sachs and Capital and Asset Manager and Bank of Chicago and things like that, it was always on a very individual level. And it does lead to almost, looking out for oneself or ensuring that you're showing up in the best light and your contribution to that team is valued over and above that. But if you are measured on more of it, and they tried to change this, didn't they, with these 360 degree reviews and appraisals, and perhaps that's helped to a certain extent, but it is still about the individual when work by its very essence is about the team. So yeah, that's very interesting indeed. Do you think that 360 reviews are they still being used? Is that still a tool that's working or not so much?
I did one a few years ago and I hated it just as much. I don't know, maybe we just instinctively don't like people telling us whether we're doing a good job or not. But I think a lot of it is not just the performance and it's not just the output, it's how valued we are. And a lot of what we seek in a workplace is validation. You know, we're always looking to be told, you're important to us, you're doing well, we like having you here, we like you, you know, you fit in, all of those sorts of things. It's all out there. There's an almost instinctive human search for validation that actually creates a lot of the tensions that we feel in the workplace. You know, there's nothing worse than seeking some validation and not getting a response. It's the silence, it's the absence of a response very often that kills us. But I think I still think we've got a long way to go in a lot of these areas. I'm not necessarily sure that the period of time we've been spending away from that sort of social contact with one another has been helping us to solve some of these issues. I think we probably put some of those on hold, but they're still ever present and we still haven't solved them today.
No, exactly. And that validation really resonates. I know that myself and a lot of mothers especially, but often fathers as well, when anyone leaves the workplace for an extended period of time, whether it be on maternity or paternity leave or to look after a sick relative or even to go traveling, often what they find is it's that lack of validation and that lack of just being rewarded for their contribution to the team that they often miss the most. Neil, we've spoken for an hour on this topic and I haven't even covered your discussion points or anything like that. I want to finish with something else from your book, which is keeping beta and then planning for day two. And I highly recommend you to just have a look at this book and pick it up and read it, and then you'll understand the context. But day two is you've completed that beta and you've got this perpetual beta, but what next? And planning for day two is as vital as planning for day one. In many respects, it's even more difficult. Thereafter, entropy will be at work, mixed with the euphoria and the exhaustion of having achieved what we set out to do. And you talk about sports teams in particular, once they're final, they've achieved their goal. And I want to bring this back to you. So I don't know if you've experienced this, but I certainly did. You reach a big goal, you publish your book, you've got all this euphoria, and all of a sudden it's then, what now? And it's a bit deflating. So do you think it's about then updating the vision and updating the goals so that once again you've got this combined goal or visions for your team to continue to strive towards?
I said that to a friend of mine who published a book the other day, exactly that. Are you experiencing the what now feeling yet? His came out sort of a couple of months before mine, and you do get that because you think you almost think that the job is done and really it's just beginning. No one's read it, or one or two people have read it helping you to write it, and actually you've got to start that dialogue with everyone that's likely to read it. So there is a huge sort of what now emptiness sometimes that you're staring into thinking, well, what do I do now? One of the things I did to try and overcome that, particularly being here and isolated, was send out the copies that I'd bought to as many people as I knew, just to get some feedback and get some traction. And obviously, given the fact that, I wasn't in a situation where I could take my wheelbarrow full of books around to the post office, it was a sort of gradual process. And that was nice. It created some continuity and a bit of dialogue leading up to Christmas. And then you sort of come back after the holidays thinking, I got this book out, it's been out for a month, what really does happen now? And then you can't help it. You might start thinking, well, what did I miss? What should I cover? What should I do? What should I do now? But we have to remind ourselves to enjoy it for a moment as well. It's a lot of emotion goes into it, as I'm sure you experience. It's a much more emotional process than many people realize. Yeah. You do have a lot of self-doubt and you do question yourself and question what you know. And then, it's out there. And then once it's out there, nothing you can do about it. You can't change anything. Things you wish you'd included, or things you wish you hadn't said, they're all out there. But I think the experience in the first book was I just met loads of people through publishing a book and had some great conversations. And I still get people now saying, I've just come across your first book and, you know, and asking me about it. And I wouldn't have missed that for anything. I think it's been amazing.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that we've met, Neil, and I'm really glad that I read this book as well. So I do highly recommend it. I bought my copy on Amazon so I can give it a proper review, which I would. And just for, again, for small business owners and entrepreneurs who are listening, I feel that there are some fundamental concepts that will work for you, not just for large corporates. So thank you very much, Neil, for joining me today.
Really good chat, and look forward to some dialogue in the future as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. We'll stay there. I'd love to have a chat with you after this. That was our podcast for today. Thanks again to Neil. We have now the schedule that I've published is incorrect. I made a big mistake. It wasn't anyone else's fault. It definitely was mine. I've made a mistake. Our next podcast is going to be on Thursday the 14th with Justin Shee, who is the founder, a very, very young founder, I have to add, of Cohab, which is this very interesting intergenerational assisted co-living space concept. And I met Justin when he was just floating the idea to a number of people, and I thought it was a great idea then. I think it's a great idea now, and I'm looking forward to discussing that with him. So that's live wherever you've watched today on at 1 o'clock on the 14th of January. The other thing that I'll say is that if you're noticing that some of your socials are a bit quiet, I think that's because everyone's over on Clubhouse at the moment. It is interesting. It's polarizing. It's quite Marmite. I've spent a bit of time over there and I've got my view on it. I'd really like to hear your view on it as well. Go and find me. I'm at Nicole Bremner on Clubhouse. One final thing is that I really appreciate your reviews, your ratings, and if you can share, subscribe, and comment on this, it really makes such a difference to this podcast. I don't sell anything. I don't have anything to sell. I have no hidden agenda. I just really enjoy this podcast and the great people like Neil that I get to talk to. So please do leave us a rating, a review, and tell your friends about it if you enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe, and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.